The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the September-October 2024 issue. We begin with our cover story, Animals That Changed Humanity Forever. From dogs to horses, domestication was a game changer for us and for the creatures we took into our care. Humans have lived with animals for so long, it's hard to imagine there was ever a time when we didn't have furry, feathered, or four-legged companions to help us in one way or another. Although the number varies depending on how you define domestication, science has identified dozens of species that we've either outright domesticated or with whom we have at least forged connections for our mutual benefit. Whatever the criteria, domestication was by no means a simple or linear process. It happened over millennia at different times and places across the globe. But once domestication got rolling, we didn't just change the animals we brought into our lives. They changed us, too. Humanity would look very different today and possibly not have thrived to the extent it has without the assistance and support of domesticated animals to help us hunt, protect our resources, bear burdens, provide food, supply materials for clothing and tools, and so much more. Here's a look at just three of the most important creatures we've made part of our lives. What would we do without them? Man's best and oldest friend. Zooarchaeologists and geneticists don't dispute that the faithful dog was our first friend from the animal kingdom. The relationship began back in our days as nomadic hunter-gatherers, well before we started farming or building any kind of civilization. Handy for hunting, protection, pest control, and companionship, dogs may have even provided one of the developmental advantages that allowed Homo sapiens to outcompete Neanderthals. Exactly when we first attempted to domesticate dogs is a bone of contention, though. Some archaeological evidence has pointed to dogs splitting off from wolves as much as 40,000 years ago, but they may not have been domesticated then. A 2021 study in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, or PNAS, analyzed ancient dog DNA, with the results indicating that Ice Age hunters in Siberia may have been domesticating dogs at least 23,000 years ago. Unambiguously domesticated dogs are common in the archaeological record beginning around 14,000 years ago. No matter when it happened, our early and long-standing association with dogs makes for a striking case in coevolution. No other species has been so thoroughly integrated into human society. Until recently, it was widely supposed that early hunter-gatherers adopted wild wolf pups, abducting them from their dens or perhaps fostering them after killing their parents. Selectively bred over generations for docility and tractability, these lupine changelings morphed into something close to the canines we know today, so the story goes. Except, this appealing origin tale doesn't really hold up to modern scrutiny. For one thing, studies of wild wolf pups raised in captivity demonstrate that no matter how much attention, training, and affection are lavished on captive-raised wolf puppies, they remain wolves. They don't take to training well and constantly clash with their trainers for dominance. I don't know that many hunter-gatherers would have had the time or patience to deal with a wolf pup, and I don't know why they would want to, says Angela Perry, lead author of the PNAS study, and an archaeologist with the consultancy group Chronicle Heritage. In all likelihood, domestication happened gradually, perhaps even accidentally. Wolves probably became acclimated to humans while scavenging the remains of their kills, and in doing so would have kicked off the domestication process themselves. Humans may well have seen some benefits to having more tolerant wolves around, especially if their presence kept other predators and pests away, or made rival groups think twice about raiding or competing for local resources. Wolves on their way to becoming dogs were a great alarm system, says Robert Quinlan, professor of anthropology at Washington State University. The offspring of these more acclimatized wolves could have been chosen by humans for even more useful skills, such as hunting. The growing relationship may have been reinforced by the innate human attraction to features like wide eyes and shortened faces, seen in wolf puppies and exaggerated in domestic dogs, even in adulthood. Whatever the reasons for the initial attraction, dog domestication was not a singular event, but rather constituted a multitude of events, spaced across geography and time. Perry cautions that it can be nearly impossible to tell if early canine remains were dogs or wolves. Neither their morphology nor their genetics are smoking guns when it comes to domestication, she says. Around 12,000 to 14,000 years ago is where we start seeing morphological and genetic differences in early remains that are so different from those of wolves that we can confidently say we're seeing domestic dogs. Skulls with shorter faces and wider eye sockets become more frequent in the archaeological record beginning in this period. The tendency of both humans and wolves to use facial cues in social communication may have been one of the factors that helped to cement the bond between our two species. In fact, the ability to communicate through and read facial cues is highly enhanced in domestic dogs as compared to their wild ancestors. Dogs have actually developed new facial musculature in the domestication process. Notably, a muscle responsible for furrowing the brow, according to a 2019 PNAS study. The resulting puppy dog eyes may have helped to strengthen the caretaking response that probably played into our initial desire to associate with canines. Pups seem to know we respond to their expressions too. They have been observed to make more of them when we're paying attention than when we are not. Dogs also make extensive use of eye contact in order to communicate with us. This has been seen in research of both domesticated dogs and some non-domesticated dogs, such as dingoes. We found that the dingoes are much more likely to make eye contact than wolves, says Angie Johnston, primary investigator at the Center for Canine Cognition at Boston College. Dingoes are roughly intermediate in the domestication process, not quite dogs, not quite wolves. Her lab studies have shown that dogs make even more eye contact than dingoes, suggesting that this communicative ability has been enhanced through the domestication process. Domestic dogs are also skilled at using gaze alteration to direct their human companion's attention towards problems they are unable to solve, such as extracting a hidden treat from a container. They are able to use human-like eye movements, nods, and pointing to locate an object. Wolves, and even highly intelligent apes, perform poorly on tests of their ability to understand such gestures. Yet for dogs, this ability appears to be innate, even for young puppies. The road connecting human and dog still has plenty of bumps in it. However, initiatives like the Many Dogs Project, a consortium of researchers focused on canine science, hope to replicate the wide-ranging and often contradictory experiments that have sought to explain the dog-human connection. Meanwhile, at the societal level, we still wrestle with questions of animal welfare. Many purebred dogs suffer from congenital disorders and animal abandonments, although declining, are still a major issue. Domestication, even at this advanced stage, is still not set in stone. According to the World Organization for Animal Health, 75% or more of dogs worldwide are free-ranging animals, existing in a liminal state between wildness and domesticity. At the same time, ample evidence shows the value placed on this interspecies relationship. Pew Research Center data and other research consistently shows that the vast majority of dog owners, as much as 90%, consider their pets to be members of the family. Cats, incidentally, tend to score lower on the family member scale of affection compared to dogs. But then, our relationship with felines evolved rather differently. When the cat came home, if it were possible to get one to go on the record, cats might well argue that they have never been domesticated. They certainly weren't when we first met them, nor for a long time thereafter. A 2017 analysis of ancient cat DNA indicates that humanity's first attempts to domesticate cats could have occurred 9,000 or more years ago in the Near East. A second wave of cat domestication took place several thousand years later in Egypt. However, cats lived in proximity to humans for centuries without actually being domesticated. They first enjoyed a mutually beneficial relationship with us. Wild cats could have been drawn to humans because our early agricultural efforts generated both resources and waste. Food and trash attract vermin, and vermin attracts cats. But although cats have been alongside humans for most of the time we've lived in complex societies, the exact chronology of their domestication is still unclear. In any case, there's little doubt that cats spread through multiple ancient civilizations, often becoming an important fixture in the lives of the people there. In some cases, cats even took on symbolic religious and cultural importance. Not all cultures treated this domestic relationship equally, though. Here are a few examples of the ways in which ancient peoples viewed their feline companions. 1. Spiritual cats in ancient Egypt. In Egypt, where cats are believed to have been domesticated about 4,000 years ago, felines played an important role in the spiritual pantheon. Some ancient Egyptians offered cat figurines and mummified cats to the feline goddess Bastet. Many of them came from catteries, businesses that specialized in mummifying and selling various types of dead cats adorned in various ways, although it's unclear how these mummies met their ends. Aside from what may or may not have happened in catteries, however, many felines lived a fairly comfortable life in ancient Egypt. Much as today, the animals kept pests from homes in life and in the afterlife, according to some interpretations of Tumart. Ancient Egyptians also believed that cats brought good luck, thus honoring them with fancy accessories and a rich diet. 2. Felines in Roman times. In ancient Rome, cats weren't always the first choice for pets, at least not as a form of pest control. In fact, many people instead kept weasels or even snakes to keep rodents out of their homes. That gradually changed as Romans began to view felines as cleaner than weasels. Cats were also appreciated for other qualities. In particular, they were seen as symbols of independence and freedom. They certainly had the run of the place. Historical accounts record that cats were the only animals granted the freedom to enter Roman temples. Even today, places in modern Rome are famously populated by free and feral cats, such as the cat colony that lives around the Largo di Torre Argentina, part of the ruins where Julius Caesar was murdered in 44 BCE. 3. Literature of cats in ancient India. Cats figure in some of the most important epics of the Hindu faith, including the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. Even the 17th century story Puss in Boots, written by French author Charles Perrault, may have been derived from an Indian collection of fables dating back more than two millennia. There isn't much reference in either in earlier Vedic literature to cats as pets, but in the period following the 5th century BCE, cats do appear more in the literature of the timeline. 4. Evidence of cats in ancient China. Across Asia, cats have been historically regarded as symbols of good luck and gifted with supernatural powers, such as seeing ghosts and warding away evil. Certainly, they were useful in warding away any vermin getting into food stores. Some of the earliest evidence of cats living alongside humans in China dates to 5,300 years ago. In 2013, researchers undertook an analysis of archaeological and isotopic evidence of cats found on the farming site Quanhuchun in the country's northwest. The cat remains there seemingly revealed that the animals weren't eating a strictly carnivorous diet, which would be expected for wild cats. They were likely situated early in the process of domestication. More research is needed to settle the matter, though. There and back again, a horse tale. If history had gone a little differently, or some early daredevil had second thoughts about jumping on the back of one, horses might today be considered comparable to cattle instead of the noblest of livestock. We know from cave art dating back 30,000 years that the earliest relationship between human and horse was likely one of predator and prey, and that wild horses were hunted for food. Early domestication efforts, approximately 5,500 years ago, are typically credited to people living in the western Eurasian steppe, who were thought to use horses initially as a ready supply of meat and milk. A 2023 Science Advances study of ancient human skeletons showed evidence that at least some people were riding the beasts as early as 4,500 to 5,000 years ago. Signs of physical stress and bone fractures in the skeletons were consistent with bodily wear and tear typically sustained by people who spent time on horseback. Clearly, it didn't take humans long to view horses as more than a source of nourishment or beast of burden. Over time, the horse's power and stamina would provide humanity with advantages that even the faithful dog couldn't fetch us. Horses permitted exponentially expanded opportunities for transport, trade, communications, and particularly warfare. For better or worse, their strength and speed revolutionized human conflict. Over the centuries, inventions like the saddle, the stirrup, and equestrian armor transformed both steeds and their riders into ever more devastating combatants. Horses were so effective on the field of battle that they wouldn't be outclassed until the early 20th century, when armored vehicles inexorably began to supplant traditional cavalry. The mobility and durability of horses also made them important to the colonization efforts of various civilizations throughout history. Though we tend not to think of colonizers as having hooves, horses played a pivotal part in the colonization of the Americas, for example. Horses helped European conquistadors and colonists carry their things, travel from settlement to settlement, and move further into unfamiliar territories. And yet, in spite of their historical significance, questions continue to surround the colonial history of horses. For instance, where were these horses originally from? A PLOS One study published in 2022 answered this question through archaeology. Identifying and analyzing one of the oldest archaeological specimens of domesticated horse in the Western Hemisphere, this study confirmed a theory that the first modern horses in the Americas came from the Iberian Peninsula. Though the ancestors of modern-day domestic horses roamed the Americas in the distant past, all native species of equus, a genus that includes horses, asses, and zebras, disappeared from the landscape approximately 10,000 years ago. They only returned, this time in the form of the domesticated horse, Equus caballus, with the arrival of Europeans around 500 years ago. Historical records state that these domesticated horses sailed from the Iberian Peninsula to the Caribbean on Spanish ships. But there wasn't much archaeological evidence to corroborate the story until researchers did a genetic analysis of an equine tooth fragment from the 16th century, which confirmed the origin of the first domesticated horses in the Western Hemisphere. The analysis of the introduction of modern horses in the Americas is such a fascinating yet understudied topic, the study authors noted in a press release announcing the study's results. Our results support the Iberian origins of these animals. After finding the tooth fragment at the Spanish colonial settlement of Puerto Real in modern-day Haiti, the researchers sequenced its mitochondrial genome. The sequence revealed that the tooth's genetics matched that of a lineage of horses concentrated in southern Europe called Equine Haplogroup A, suggesting the tooth belonged to a horse with Iberian connections. Further supporting this conclusion is the fact that the horse's closest living relatives are a population of feral horses that have lived on Chincoteague Island in Virginia for centuries, supposedly introduced there as a result of a 16th century Spanish shipwreck. Further work on feral horse populations along the Atlantic coast of the U.S. and continued horse archaeoeconomic sampling promises to further clarify our understanding of how horses colonized the Western Hemisphere, the authors concluded in their paper. The first livestock. As humans settled down, hunted less, and farmed more, we gradually enticed many of the beasts collectively known as cattle into our control. In 2012, an international team of researchers determined that all cattle today could be descended from a small herd of oxen approximately 10,000 years ago. As a form of livestock, cattle offered a level of food security we couldn't have hoped to match as hunters. But when it comes to identifying the first domesticated livestock, that title usually goes to the humble yet durable goat. According to a 2021 PNAS study, the oldest known livestock DNA, found in Iran, belonged to a goat and dates to around 8200 BCE, although humans likely were domesticating goats a few thousand years earlier than that, just as we were transitioning from hunter-gatherer to farmer-herder. Rugged and well-suited to varied terrain, wild goats evolved from the Bezoar ibex. Goats provided a ready source of food, milk and meat, and other useful materials, including hair, hide, bone, and sinew for everything from clothes to tools, Even their droppings were handy. Their dung was fuel for burning. Collecting your thoughts. Research is revealing that what happens in the brain when we collect and categorize coveted items and how doing so may have cognitive benefits. My husband, Brandon, has been collecting toys since the summer of 1996 when he was 17 years old, beginning with the 3-inch Obi-Wan Kenobi he purchased to dress up his dorm room windowsill. A motley crew of Star Wars action figures followed, and eventually what began as an easy-to-contain collection morphed into a 3-car garage packed with 450 Pez dispensers, 1,000-plus action figures, and a 6-foot-tall Spider-Man. Like his toys, Brandon is in good company. An estimated 1 in 3 adults collects something, and research suggests that the popular pastime could come with cognitive perks. Through a range of mechanisms that scientists are still teasing out, collecting may enhance memory, forge new connections in the brain, and even trigger the body's relaxation response. According to neuroscientist and Chinese porcelain collector Shirley Mueller, collecting feeds the pleasure center of the brain, but without the drawbacks of alcohol, gambling, or nicotine. Collecting is a way to feel a sense of safety and comfort, says Mueller, who is also the author of the book Inside the Head of a Collector, Neuropsychological Forces at Play. It's a way for the collector to temporarily let go of the burdens in their lives and find joy in the moment. Of course, collecting is not a new phenomenon. More than 100,000 years ago, our ancestors foraged for crystals, shells, and other non-utilitarian objects, just as they foraged for food, a habit reflected in the hordes of rock and mineral hounds today. Amassed without any apparent practical purpose, these ancient collections may hint at the modern motivations to accumulate. While some people collect as a statement of who they are, others collect as an investment or a source of pleasure, impulses that ring as true today as they might have rung many millennia ago. While the motivations to collect are varied, they typically revolve around developing a more positive sense of self, says Brandon Shamil, a comic book collector and psychology professor at Texas A&M University. That distinguishes collecting from hoarding. With hoarding, stuff is acquired indiscriminately. There's no methodological thought process behind what's procured. And instead of creating a sense of self-worth, the behavior typically makes hoarders feel bad about themselves. But even collecting of the non-hoarding variety can be pathological, says Brian Appleby, a neuropsychiatrist with University Hospitals in Cleveland. In the early 1990s, psychoanalyst Werner Münstenberger described collecting as an attempt to fill a void from childhood. Decades earlier, Sigmund Freud viewed the practice as a form of regression, or as a means of controlling one's fears. Apply those theories to my husband, and collecting could be interpreted as Brandon's way of coming to terms with his mom bailing when he was barely out of diapers, or of creating order from a life of chaos with 3 kids, a dog, and a demanding job. A more scientifically sound theory, Mueller states, is the pleasure principle. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, functional MRI or fMRI technology uncovered what happens in the brain when we experience joy. The nucleus accumbens, also known as the brain's pleasure center, lights up. In the late 2000s, the same technology revealed that the nucleus accumbens also activates whenever we make a meaningful purchase, in part because the anticipated gain makes us feel good. Collectors are drawn to collecting as a means of bolstering the self by setting up goals that are tangible, attainable, and provide the collector with concrete feedback or progress. Schmachel reports in a paper published in Leisure Sciences. It also taps into people's need to seek challenge. And unlike more nebulous goals like be a good husband, collecting provides quantifiable evidence of success. Brandon can peruse the items in our garage and see just how far he has come since that first acquisition in college. He now has 21 Obi-Wan figurines. In fact, many collectors say their top motive to collect is to gain a sense of skill, success, or competence. No matter the motivation for collecting, there's no disputing that the activity can offer collectors a feeling of confidence or of certainty in uncertain times. Perhaps that's one reason the pandemic spawned an uptick in collecting, even among those who were previously non-collectors. Sales of stamps and coins surged, and business in vinyl records, vintage comics, and memorabilia also boomed. According to Schmeichel, collecting can also serve as a means of symbolic immortality. Brandon can control his toys. They'll never leave him. And barring a house fire, earthquake, or other natural disaster, they'll undoubtedly outlive him. Brandon can recall with amazing detail not only the events of his life, but years when movies came out, obscure actors' names, birthdays of people he hasn't seen in decades. His memory is sharp, almost photographic. I used to think it was all genetics, but as I watched his toy collection grow in size and scope, I saw how he cataloged every shelf according to some elaborate, known-only-to-him algorithm. I began to wonder whether collecting toys is somehow training his brain. Collecting requires attaining knowledge. You have to figure out where you can find the coveted items, what they're worth, and how you will organize and display your collectibles. Mueller says, those activities stimulate areas of the brain involved in executive functioning, skills that include working memory, multitasking, and perhaps ironically, impulse control. So just like putting together a puzzle, learning a new language, or playing the daily Wordle, collecting can be a form of exercise for the mind, Mueller says. On a psychological level, research in Frontiers in Human Neuroscience shows that tangible objects have unique effects on brain functions, specifically related to memory. The brain processes objects along a ventral pathway, which is thought to control how we perceive things, as well as along a dorsal pathway, which controls how we interact with objects as well as their sensory characteristics, says researcher Jacqueline Snow, professor of cognitive neuroscience at the University of Nevada, Reno. Unlike pictures, real objects amplify brain responses in action-related areas in the dorsal pathway, and that may translate to deeper processing. Since visualizing objects stimulates many areas of the brain simultaneously, Snow says it's plausible that Brandon's affinity for toy collecting strengthens his memories. Each object is associated with a person, experience, or a moment in time, and he can better recall those things because he has a tangible reminder. In that way, collectibles act as a physical time machine. Every item in his collection is both a piece of Brandon's history and a cue for his memory. Indeed, Appleby tells me that objects are one way to trigger memory recall for people with dementia. But even without a memory disorder, collectibles, whether spoons, toys, or shot glasses, can help people hold on to memories. Studies in children suggest they retain information better when they're presented with objects rather than words or pictures, the standard approach to learning for children in America, Snow says. That seems to hold true in our household. Our kids not only know the origin story of every DC and Marvel superhero, they can also recite every U.S. president's name, presumably because they learned them through a physical representation, Brad's collection of presidential Pez dispensers. Ask them to recite the Gettysburg Address, though, which is part of their fourth grade curriculum, and they're stumped. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.